where Bob Winters.
And what was the relation to
he was president of one of the companies up there, Rio Tinto. I forgot which company it was. Mm-hmm. He had left politics and was in Toronto. And we had a three-way on the phone. I got told I wasn't eavesdripping. I was told by the minister I could go on the other phone, and he was on it. We talked to Bob, and Bob said, "Oh, he said, for God's sake, don't send your military people up here. You'd think I primed him, I hadn't." He said, "You know, the morale of these people is low. They'll only want the military in, so long as they're sort of priming the pump. But they'll sort of resent them, you know, because some of them are unemployed, the army will be paid, and it's going to cost you a lot of money. And then if there is a demand for more fissionable material, well, then it's as soon as the market comes back, we want to kick you all out again." But he made more a plea as a soldier. And George, but this was the sort of man. One of the things you must admire about Perks, we all make mistakes, but as a politician, never thought twice but to call up Bob on the phone. "Hello, Bob, George speaking."
Yeah.
A former cabinet minister of the opposition party. And he spoke to him just as he would to you and me. As a friend, you know, never thought any of that Bob would ever trick him, which he wouldn't.
Yeah.
There were two men, each thought so highly of the other, that he wasn't afraid to do this.
Yeah.
Now, I don't suppose he'd like to have got out in the newspaper that he was discussing this with a former opposition minister, but to me it showed great sense.
Do you know of any other instances where he did this?
Some may come to my mind. Yeah, that one was triggered off, of course, by this one, and it was in his office that was made. It was a very nice chat.
There's one here on HMC as Grios. Now, how much you know about this? I don't know. This was in January 1960 when the Undersecretary of State for External Affairs was requested to commence formal negotiations with the United States for the transfer and loan of the submarine Burfish, I think it was.
Mm-hmm.
And the Burfish was rechristened the Grills,
mm-hmm.
Which evidently came into commission in 1961.
Mm-hmm.
I think, I'm not sure, but I think this is the first one that we had, isn't it? We had a couple in World War One, but
we had one or two British submarines.
Oh, already by this time, did we?
One, I think, operating from Halifax, but it was. If I remember now, this could easily be checked, and my memory isn't good enough, but it wasn't. I think they had some British crew on it. They didn't sort of hand it over and say, "Here it is, you play with it."
Yeah.
But I think this was the first one we could call our own, more or less. Yes, remember?
Yes, I think you're right there, because I remember reading the letter, and it should be, may even be in here somewhere, where the British had a number, and they were willing to loan us a couple. We would keep it operational, and this, that, and the other thing.
That's right.
But it was still to be considered theirs.
That's right.
I think more or less on the line of the aircraft carrier at the end of World War II, something of that nature. I'm not sure. There's one here that's rather interesting, of course, under considering the news last night, and that was with respect to the hydrofoil. Now, here again.
What was the news last night? I missed it.
Oh, the Americans are very interested in it and may buy some.
Our hydrofoil?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay.
This is a memo Folks is writing to the minister. With regard to the hydrofoil, this was a pet program of E.L. Davis, the former vice chairman of the Defense Research Board.
That's right.
And it was not, as far as I can find out, an urgent requirement of the services. When this question was raised with the chairman of the Defense Research Board, he pointed out that the United Kingdom First Sea Lord was interested in the program. However, it has no priority whatsoever as far as our services are concerned. and I have a note to myself that the Naval Research Establishment at Halifax had been doing research on the hydrofoil craft for at least 10 years prior to 58-59. Of course, it is working there, but this has been going on for ages and ages and ages. The Americans were interested, the British were interested. Again, your memories and that, what they might be, I'm not sure. Whether you can, as an army man, consider this might be a drain, or whether this was another bobcat coming up, or precisely what?
I don't remember it very well. Details, I remember the discussions about it. I remember we were quite happy that they go on doing limited tests on it, but I think it was our feeling that things of this sort, and an example came up also building submarines in Canada, that we would be getting into something where we had too little knowledge, and that it takes some of these more sophisticated things would take a country with a lot more money and a lot more skills than we have. And while we build trucks and cars and so, not one is designed in Canada. We don't have designers. The Buick you drive, or the Ford, or Chevrolet, they're designed in the United States. That's one thing. Designing, testing, yeah. Getting it ready, and then handing the working drawings over to a Canadian factory. So we did not have a strong base of people who could start at the drawing board to develop these things. Now, you might have scientists who have very good ideas, but there's quite a bridge from finding out something scientifically, carrying it through the engineering and production phases. And we simply, I don't believe, had the expertise. And we had hoped that if we could think up some good ideas, as our scientific brains, I think we'd be very... very good chance. Why not hand it over, make a contribution in the scientific field, and hand over the idea to someone, and let them call it American or British, whatever you like. Because they had better people in design, production, and engineering, and they had more money. So I think this was generally our feeling. But one of the points for an area like British Columbia. You wonder about the hydrofoil, the one that was running across to Seattle. It hit a sunken log and has never run since. And they've discarded the idea.
I didn't realize that.
Oh, yes. They remember the one that was running over here to Victoria? Well, it hit a deadhead and really had a major smash-up. No one was badly injured, but the... ship was bad. They're up, they come up and they reach a certain speed, but these foils are in the water and they're hit.
Mm-hmm.
Now, at the same time, the British were just developing, and we thought to watch them develop, it would have some really good military applications, and I say military, army, as well as naval. This one that lifts off in a pad of air.
Yeah.
And
it goes in sea or land, isn't it?
Yes. And I'd had a short trip in one of the prototypes, and I was very impressed with it. Well, now they're getting them larger and larger, and the sort of log that would put... Now, in the open sea, if you're out in open seas or around Britain, you don't have all the wood that you have around British Columbia shores.
Yeah.
And the hydrofoil in the Mediterranean, too, the answer was first class.
Mm-hmm.
But the other one, while it at the moment doesn't go as fast, I believe they're getting these, I call them the air cushion type, up to 50 miles an hour or so, which is pretty damn fast.
Yeah,
and if you have debris from a broken ship or wood or so, over the top you go, and if you need a hunter type of vessel like this, which could be launched off a destroyer, down away it goes.
Quite an idea. It must have been quite a ride.
Quite a ride.
This is the idea of the two, if I remember correctly,
is you have some sort of a fan or a thrust or what have you that gets you up.
Up.
And your speed or your thrust comes from a jet or a fan or something of that nature, a propeller.
Right. And you have just a skirt down that's holding this.
Yeah.
Strangely enough, this cushion of air is enough. It's just to get your lift off and away you go. So, now it would have, it might be very useful across the desert. Very good for crossing rivers and so it's not the sort of thing you'd weave through the woods with because...
No, Lord, you couldn't.
But it certainly seemed to I think a lot of the Army technical people, that this was a better thing to put your money on. When I say your money, place your bets on, because we weren't doing the development, and it was very interesting to see someone else do it.
There's one other here on the La Crosse missile. And evidently in the last, in September 58, around there, under somewhat skillful questioning, Allard indicated that Canada would be getting the new La Crosse ground-to-ground missile, a statement that was made before a cabinet decision was taken.
Well, it was in September
58.
September, October
58.
Well, if your tape's long enough, I'll give you a funny story about that. I was... I had just been appointed CGS on the 1st of September. And I wanted to get around as quickly as I could to see all the commands. I didn't go to Central Command, where I'd just spent 3 years, so I started out west. And I asked Mr. Perks if I could take a week's leave to do some shoeing in Winnipeg while I was out. Because I hadn't had my leave that year, knowing I was going to be to Ottawa, and this was fine. So I was up, my brother and I have a shooting lodge at the bottom of Lake Manitoba. We were enjoying this, about my third day there, I guess, and my ADC arrived, was waiting when I got back from the morning shoot. Said, you are going back to Ottawa very quickly. The C-4, that was the top plane the Air Force had, and they were training their crew to take them to Japan. We'll be in Portage la Prairie at 4 o'clock this afternoon. So Noni was with me, and we packed up as quickly as we could and drove off. And it was Thanksgiving Day, I know.
Oh.
Because they were serving a turkey dinner, and Jack had bought champagne. They were trying all their waiters up, so we were really gloriously treated. There was just Noni and Jack and myself on the plane back to Ottawa, and I said, were you able to find out in Winnipeg? He was in Winnipeg. What the minister wants me back this urgently for? Well, I said, all I know, I've heard, I phoned your office, and I hear it's about the Honest John.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the Honest John. I don't know how it got across, but it was Honest John. And when I got there, there was a study at the Hull Armories and explaining what the Army was trying to do. And on cross-examination, it's alleged that Jean Lard said, well, the CGS was already signed the contract to Manfred. And he told this to Dave McIntosh. And the headline I saw when I got back was that he told this, not only told this to McIntosh, this was McIntosh writing, but had called him up and said, for God's sakes, you know, say it, didn't say it.
Yeah.
that was all a miserable article. And I must say that the minister was indeed extremely annoyed.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he had okayed this conference and having the press in what we were doing. I kept out of it because it had been rehearsed for about 3-4 months before I got there. It was taking place about 2 weeks after I got there, and I was fine that the vice chief handled it. Well, this was over the Honest John, and indeed I had signed a contract to man.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's a request.
Yeah.
And and that's a letter asking. We had the budget for it and asking for so many. So in what had happened, I don't suppose this had probably had not got off the minister's desk to cabinet, and allegedly this article said it was before cabinet or something of that order, and it didn't embarrass the minister greatly, because it was not one, not a weapon that you could argue was for home defense, except if you're defending your home in Western Europe.
Yeah.
I mean, the chances of anyone landing here and having to use it, it was bought as a weapon for our brigade group in NATO.
Yeah. Yes, it mentioned that here. He, which would probably be... This is later. Diefenbaker speaking. Diefenbaker went on to say that half the battery would be deployed with the Canadian Brigade Group in Germany, and the remainder at the Canadian Artillery School in
Shiloh.
Canada.
In Shiloh, and they would have, they had a sand-filled training head. Now, this would represent the rocket ballistically, and what they would do, they would train, and all the techniques, and they would, so many would be shot, but they would just be sand-filled.
Yeah.
So that was the reason, and for rotation, if you have a battery overseas, it was a training battery, and those training people would rotate, you know, with the chaps in Europe,
mm-hmm.
More or less one-for-one basis. That was the idea.
And it goes on to say that the lacrosse was capable of, was capable of carrying an atomic warhead, but there was no statement at that time about nuclear warheads for the missile. Now,
that's right.
Yes, this gets on to the Honest John. They're one and the same thing, are they not? Or is the Honest John an improvement?
Second generation. When I was in CENTCOM and Hart Graham was CGS, they were considering the lacrosse. There's a Little John and Honest John that came along later.
Mm-hmm.
And I preferred the Honest John because it was had a much bigger warhead and a longer range. Charles Folks preferred the Little John. It had a shorter range, much lighter weapon, but it could be carried by aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
And I was afraid if we got it, we'd get one little battery on the assumption that we would be able to deploy it quickly in Europe, and we wouldn't have the air transport to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And if you are going to have an effective brigade group and show that you've done everything to give your soldiers the means of carrying out their task and protecting themselves, then I felt you had to have a thing with the soldiers on the ground, right there and then, as part of the ground deterrent. Because if everybody took this attitude, the Americans and everyone else, and said, fine, we'll keep them all here and fly them over, that doesn't carry as much weight. Doesn't give your allies who are sitting on the doorstep of a potential enemy the same comfort.
Well, now, is this... this was another case, was it not? When you get the Honest John, whereby, nevertheless, were they warheads?
Yes, they're warheads.
Yeah, you had atomic warheads for them.
That's right. And there was an HE for it as well. There was a high explosive warhead.
But this would be, again, a double key affair, presumably, or would it be?
Yes.
Under NATO.
Oh, absolutely.
You were still double key there?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
We had to build the storage area for them.
Yeah.
And they had to be under... Well, I think this is... It, I believe, and you're better, you know more than I do about this, but... And I think their custody in foreign soil is more token. I mean, if they have a law, if they've made a law, then I think they have to obey it. Now, you either take it under these circumstances or you leave it alone.
Yeah.
And, in fact, it was a much better way for us to have them anyway.
But it seemed to me that there was a great deal of contention on the Honest John.
Of course there was.
People saying that that these damn things, even though they're over in Europe, are filled with sand or something of that nature. Or maybe they were
bringing that in with the whole question of nuclear arms.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. There's one or two things here. I'm not going to tell you. One is a bit off the record, but, whether I should go into that or not.
Well, we can keep it
quiet. You can think about it and how you'd explain it. When I first put up the contract demand, I quite naturally put up the number of training warheads,
mm-hmm.
and I put up the number of operational warheads. And this is, there are all your margins and reserves and so on. Put it in. Well, I had to rewrite the letter just to order the weapon and put no warheads on. Mr. Perks wouldn't accept it. So I had a long private chat with him, and he was what I think first-class minister.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't say, now look, Ben, you know perfectly well you're going to get them. Because I said, well, Mr. Minister, if we don't get the warheads, we may as well not spend the money on the weapon because it's of no value. And if anyone suggests use AT, I know less expensive ways of spending money than firing. The whole rocket is spent. It's finished.
Yeah.
And it costs damn nearly as much as an 8-inch gun, which will fire hundreds and hundreds of rounds. But of course, it wasn't as big a bang. And of course, it is not as accurate as an 8-inch. It's a super heavy. We call them super heavies. Remember the last war we had? British and American regiments attached to us with it. It's not as accurate, but it didn't have to be. If you have a nuclear warhead on, it doesn't matter if you're you miss by 100 yards or so.
Yeah. Who's worried?
So I felt in my discussion with him, and I admired him as a minister, without saying so, I knew perfectly well he understood that there was no use getting him. I wanted to be no party of ordering something for which we couldn't get ammunition.
Yeah.
But we better get them. So he accepted the thing. We got them. And we were negotiating with the Americans. We never intended to bring a nuclear warhead to Canada. All we had to do then was negotiate with Americans that we would have the nuclear warheads. And we did. We knew if we bought them, we would have them over in Germany. And they knew exactly where we were. The storage area was around Sustainer Barrel someplace, very close to... we didn't have it up in our deployment area. We had it back.
Yeah, that's what I suspect training. You would have, yeah.
Oh, yes. And then it moved. Well, you didn't want just where the cat's paw would go over the line of...
Yeah.
But you had it there, and we had our schools and areas for the people to live, and that's how it came about. But there was no doubt in my mind at all, there was no doubt in the mind of anyone in the Army that we would be without. Now, I can't tell you exactly. Be without nuclear warheads. Now, I don't know, and I do not think that we had the buildings built, completed, and the warheads in before I left in October 61. But it was well along the way, and we certainly had the arrangements that we could get them from.
Yeah.
We knew where the Americans knew where we were. We knew where they had them stored, so it was...
Well, why this initial action by Perks in requesting, or at least suggesting that you... you order the weapons, but not the ammunition.
I think he felt that when it went to cabinet,
that
it might spark up. See, this is a decision I don't believe that they would make fully at the Cabinet Defense Committee. I think they would, the whole cabinet would be out, because there may have been some who had real misgivings about a warhead, and I think he felt that. But it's two things there immediately.
Yeah.
And as it turned out, I think, again, I laughed before, I don't think we needed, in fact, to put it up that way, because we were able to arrange it without a purchase.
Yeah. Interesting, my God. Well, I'm slightly starving. How about you?
Well,
I think that...
Can I take that thing of mine back and just finish it? Or
absolutely, sure.
Finish it.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.